One, two, three, four.
I've lived in Philadelphia about 16 years. The book itself, the inspiration came out of my time spent in the neighborhood of Kensington in Philadelphia and interviewing a lot of the people that I met there, both longtime residents of the neighborhood and also people who were transient, a lot of people struggling with addiction, and a lot of women doing sex work to fund their physical addiction to opioids. You find out about their past, their road into addiction, their aspirations, their fears. I began to lead free writing workshops at an organization named St. Francis Inn, which is a longstanding food service organization in the community. They had a women's day shelter where I taught. I was really able to connect with people within the community on a quite personal level and loved my experiences in Kensington. I still go. I'm still quite close with a number of the community workers, people who run free healthcare clinics. All of it ultimately informed the writing of Long Bright River.
Liz Moore is the author of the New York Times bestselling novel, Long Bright River, which was one of Barack Obama's favorite books of the year and has been made into a Peacock television series starring Amanda Seyfried. Set against the opioid crisis and a string of mysterious murders, it's a love story between two very different sisters and their path to recovery. Moore is winner of the Rome Prize in Literature, and her other books include The God of the Woods, Heft, and The Unseen World. Liz Moore, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
So, yeah, we're excited to speak with you about Long Bright River, both its novel and its adaptation, The God of the Woods, and your body of work, which is so interesting, you know, talking about really important issues, but getting us to care about those topics through the individual stories and lives. Before we dive into the conversation, I believe you've selected a passage from Long Bright River to share with our listeners.
Yeah, I'll just read a paragraph, and this is from the point of view of the protagonist and narrator. Her name is Mickey Fitzpatrick, and been working in a neighborhood of Kensington in Philadelphia. And she, in this passage, is describing her new partner, whose name is Eddie Lafferty, in relation to herself. I've only known him an hour, but I'm getting a sense for him. He likes to talk. Already, I know more about him than he'll ever know about me, and he's a pretender, an aspirant. In other words, a phony. Someone so terrified of being called poor or weak or stupid that he won't even admit to what deficits he does have in those regards. I, on the other hand, am well aware that I'm poor, more so than ever now that Simon's checks have stopped coming. Am I weak? Probably in some ways. Stubborn, maybe. Obstinate, mulish. Reluctant to accept help even when it would serve me to. Physically afraid, too. Not the first officer to throw herself in front of a bullet for a friend. Not the first officer to throw herself into traffic in the pursuit of some vanishing perpetrator. Poor, yes. Weak, yes. Stupid, no. I'm not stupid. And that's how Mickey introduces herself.
She gets to the point. And So I was wondering what passage you would select. Mm-hmm. And you've really set up a lot of the engine of the story, and we get to see it once, her character, her relationship to other people. She's someone who really, throughout the book, and then it's dramatized slightly differently in the adaptation, keeps her cards close to her chest. She's not stupid, as you say, but she's at a vulnerable point. And just how, you know, I really liked watching her resilience, both on the page and then in the adaptation. It was interesting to see that played out in the world, which is such an internal story. So already you have a sense. Now, you at that point, the passage that you shared, for those who have not read it or seen the adaptation, there's something else. Tell us what else is driving Mickey.
One of the major things that's motivating her throughout the book and series is that her sister is missing. Her sister is somebody who has a long history of opioid use disorder. She's been addicted to opioids on and off since her middle teens, and she's also been living on and off the streets of Kensington for just as long. So Mickey is used to her disappearing sometimes, maybe getting into recovery or maybe getting a boyfriend or finding some place to live. But in this case, what's really concerning Mickey is Casey has been missing for about a month at the same time that a series of murders is beginning in the neighborhood of women who are a similar demographic to Casey. And so Mickey is extra nervous this time, and she's really starting to feel like it's her responsibility to go looking for her sister.
So yeah, just this act of looking, because she has to, she's preparing herself for her sister having gone missing, Casey, a number of times. So now this time is different. And so she's looking and she's caring more so than some of the other officers. In a way, she's a detective, but she's not a detective. Like, she's going above and beyond. She's investigating things that maybe that's not your place to do that. But she's smart and she can figure things out. And it just reminded me, and I think that this is also why your books have been like they were on Obama's best reads of the year. You've got us to care about things that we don't, it's uncomfortable, right? Like, and I was looking at before this interview at the number of homeless people in that Philadelphia area, but across America. And I don't know if these statistics are correct, but it's astonishing. And it's probably underreported that the estimates. But so often we'll pass people, I'm guilty of it. I try to look, but I don't want to look too much at the homeless or the unhoused or however you, whatever euphemism you want to put on it. But I always try to remind myself, this person was a child once. They had a family and they weren't born into this, you know, for the most part, unless sometimes refugees and those situations. So was that the engine for you? I mean, what that drove you to like, I'm going to care about this one life, but then maybe, you know, it'll get people to care about the larger situation.
Yeah, well, the book itself, the inspiration came out of my time spent in the neighborhood of Kensington in Philadelphia. I've lived in Philadelphia about 16 years. I'm not from here originally, but my husband's family is, and he is. And so one of the first experiences I had after moving to Philadelphia was going to this neighborhood to do nonfiction writing and interviewing a lot of the people that I met there, both longtime residents of the neighborhood and also people who were transient, people who were passing through the neighborhood, a lot of people struggling with addiction, and a lot of women doing sex work to fund their addiction, which is something that's quite noticeable about Kensington, the number of women who are kind of standing on the street. It's called survival sex work, doing sex work sort of to fund what is for them a physical addiction to opioids. Having direct conversations with them, of course, instantly makes them, to the interviewer, a full person. You find out about their past, their road into addiction, their aspirations, the things, their fears. My first experiences were really getting to know the women of Kensington very personally and intimately. Subsequently, I began to lead free writing workshops at an organization named St. Francis Inn, which is a longstanding food service organization in the community. They had a Women's Day shelter where I taught. I was really able to connect with people within the community on a quite personal level and loved my experiences in Kensington. I still go. I'm still quite close with a number of the community workers living in Kensington, people who run free healthcare clinics, people who run St. Francis Inn. And so none of it was overt research for the book. It was more just sort of like lived experiences that I was having. But I suppose all of it ultimately informed the writing of Long Bright River.
No, it's interesting. I mean, I wonder, because I know that also that you teach creative writing, you know, to others, to university students. And I'm wondering, you know, what that experience of what kind of stories come out. I don't know, it's not a sharing, critiquing situation. Imagine it's much, much different. A friend of mine also does this thing, Shelter Songs, where someone will come in from a shelter and they're homeless or addicts or they're veterans, and they'll create a song together. Were you working that way, writing stories together?
So in a higher education setting, the way I run workshop is everybody works on a story at home or an excerpt of a novel, brings it into workshop. Everybody's read the piece in advance and everybody comments on the piece aloud. It doesn't work to do that in a setting like St. Francis Inn because you never know who's going to show up. So first of all, the format had to be quite spontaneous. You know, any work that was produced in the hour that I was there. And second of all, there are levels of literacy among the clients of the day shelter. I ran it to select a theme that would be open enough so that people could really respond the way they wanted to. So I might choose a theme like change and would bring in three short passages of published work, either poetry or fiction or nonfiction, that I felt reflected the theme in some way. Maybe the passage of time or the changing of seasons or a personal change in the author's life. I would read them aloud. And then I would give about 10 or 15 minutes for participants in the workshop to respond, either in writing or drawing. I would always do the same exercise because I felt it was important to share kind of like of myself as well in the community. Then we would have a moment at the end, which was a free space to share. And nobody was ever, of course, required to share. It was purely voluntary. Those who had drawn pictures could talk about the pictures that they'd drawn, and those who had written something sometimes shared the piece aloud, and sometimes, or sometimes not, also shared the inspiration behind it. That was the format.
And so, as I understand that you, and I think also Amanda Seyfried have, and probably others, and you've pointed this out, like everyone has probably had an experience, either direct or indirect, of addiction. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that word change, you know, how were you changed, or how were the others on the production changed just having this moment to collaborate on a work that really addresses these important issues that we don't often talk about it, though?
I think we were all changed by working with members of the community. So one of the things that was very important to me coming onto the project, and one of the reasons that I wanted to be involved with it as an executive producer, was to make sure that the community felt represented and had a voice at the table. Fortunately, everybody else involved in the project was quite supportive of that endeavor. We had on-set and off-set consultants from the community, most notably a woman named Sarah Laurel, who founded an organization called Savage Sisters in Kensington. She came in to lead informed discussions about what the community is like now, what it has been like, also to coach our background actors on how to portray people in active addiction in a way that feels both realistic and respectful, and also to speak with our leads about their work as well. We also cast from the community. We cast some actors, but also some people with no prior acting experience who play roles that are small or sometimes large. Like there's a Kensington-based rapper named OT The Real who plays a character called Doc, who's in several episodes. And he had performance experience, but no prior acting experience. And, you know, we used graffiti artists from the community. We didn't film in Kensington because to do so, I think, would have felt intrusive in certain ways. But we did try to create a space where we could invite the community in and give them the option to participate. And those who did participate, I think, affected the type of change that you're talking about in collaborating with and communicating with our cast and crew. And I think all of them now, there's a meaning to the project that I think wouldn't have been there without the participation of the community.
Yeah, I don't know that area in Pennsylvania, but I had a real sense of it with the local art. We just said the graffiti art, the street art, it gives that investment to place where it's not just people coming from the outside and doing like an issue story. Because ultimately, if we're going to care about this issue, we have to think beyond the statistics to the individual stories and lives. So that really comes across. And in the filming, I think that, and this is obviously, you know, something that you've worked with the whole team, with co-created the series with Nikki Toscano, and the look of it and of the production designers. I know there's just a whole invisible team. It's very realistic. So I would say it's gritty, but there's something nice about this kind of bluish tone. It's also hopeful. So I don't know how that was arrived at, but I think it is beautifully done.
Thank you. Yeah, one of the things I think that was important to all of us is because I live in Philadelphia and because I've spent a bunch of time in Kensington, I know that it is not all bleak. And one of the things that we really wanted to represent was some of the lighthearted aspects of the community and some of the art and vibrancy within the community as well. So we made some changes of the book to accommodate as a method of including brightness. And by that, I mean one of the characters in the series who was a woman in the book became a man in the series, partly so that he could represent this funny thing in Philadelphia called the Mummers, which many people have not heard of outside of Philadelphia, but maybe through this series they will. But the Mummers are groups of musicians and performers, largely men, although increasingly there are women within the groups, who put on a big parade on New Year's Day and dress up in these bright sequined costumes and play. In our case, our mummer was in a string band, and so there was music in the series. And we also wanted the graffiti and the murals in the series to reflect some of the color of the community, brightness, the loud, you know, the more kind of joyful aspects of the community as well.
I want to talk about that too, talking about the brightness and the colors, because I have a little bit of a link. In my other life as a painter, I did a whole series of paintings called The Lotus Eaters.
That's crazy.
I was just a bit troubled too, because I know about the lotus, the opium, you know, what that comes from. And I think I had forgotten, though, that Tennyson's brother, he had lost one of his brothers to addiction.
Yes. Yes.
And so it's weird. So if you look at the paintings, you won't think about that. But again, maybe this is an experience of the vividness, you know?
Yeah.
So tell us about that, because there's multiple metaphors hidden within your title.
Yeah. So it took me forever to find the title of this book. It was just untitled for a long time. One of the things that I do when I'm struggling with a title is I go back to either primary source texts about an issue that I'm working with or art that has been made, poetry or songs or films. And I try to find passages that speak in some way to theme after I'm finished writing the book. And I remember searching for poetry about addiction and coming across this Tennyson poem called The Lotus Eaters, which of course uses a lot of classical mythology and references to Greco-Roman notions about the river of forgetfulness and the lotus eaters. But one of the phrases that stood out to me was the long, bright river swiftly flowing, which Tennyson used to describe the feeling of intoxication that the lotus eaters would have been under. And immediately that phrase stuck out to me as not only I love titles that have multiple axes of meaning. And one, of course, is the feeling of intoxication. Another, I thought, would be a reference to the Delaware River, which was really the birthplace of Kensington as a community, because originally it was a fishing community. Philadelphia is a city that's bordered by two rivers. At one point, I was able to use that phrase to describe a vein, the long, bright river of her vein. And then ultimately, I was able to use the phrase in reference to this kind of a roll call of people who had died of overdoses, which in speaking to people in Kensington, one of the things I began to notice is how many of them could do this terrible thing of rattling off just long lists of names of friends and family who had died due to their addiction. And so that ultimately became that sort of list, the long, bright river of departed souls, became something that I used as an introduction to the story and something that I used toward the end of the story as well. And like you, it was only after I had selected that title and decided to use part of the poem as an epigraph that I did a little bit of research into Tennyson's life and discovered that he may have been writing that poem while thinking about his sibling, which gave me chills because it's so significant to the meaning of the book as well.
Yeah, and there's a kind of odyssey within it. And and then that makes me think a lot of Mickey. And I think you used this phrase also in The God of the Woods, that long, slow decline of addiction. I think there's so many interesting themes. I don't want to give away too much about The Long Bright River, but, you know, it's not as often written about. We talk about how parents form us, but the important relationship of a very close sibling, how we form our identities alongside or compare ourselves, there's always this thing. And when that's broken, what that does. But we always think, oh, it's the parents that form us. But the relationships between close siblings, they mean so much.
Yeah, that's very true. I have a sister I'm very close with. She's younger, I'm older. She always likes me to include the disclaimer that she is not based on Casey. She's much different. But the love between us and the closeness between us is, of course, I'm sure it informs the way I describe the relationship between the sisters, especially as children. And of course, by the time they're adults, they've grown estranged for a variety of reasons.
I do want to go a little bit into the multiple interwoven causes of homelessness. You can expand upon what you found, the stories of the women you were giving writing classes to. Often the people that are meant to save and protect sometimes aren't well motivated.
Right. Yeah. So, and I don't want to spoil anything in the series, but certainly the series includes themes of police corruption. I don't think that's a spoiler. And instances of police abusing their power to extort the women of the community for sexual favors, basically. And that came out of the interviews that I did all the way back in 2009, where many of the women I spoke to described experiences they had had that were similar. At the time, I was not necessarily surprised, but definitely sort of horrified by the knowledge that this was happening. And I did a little bit of investigation on my own to see whether it had been reported on. And it hadn't at that time. And so I kept an eye out. I kept wondering whether it would be, because what I was writing was creative nonfiction. It was not traditional journalism. But finally, in 2019, so after the book had been optioned, actually, the book was optioned in 2018 to be a series and published in 2020. But in 2019, the Philadelphia Inquirer finally reported on this phenomenon in the context of a greater, somebody at the Inquirer had gained access to internal police records that revealed instances similar to the ones that the women were describing to me, along with other forms of corruption. And so it is well documented in the press at this point. So those were, the portrayal of those events in the series came from reality.
Yeah, it's really hard because I have sympathy, of course, because it's a very difficult job. So I can only think that with more investment in training, like real training, because I know that is not long enough for what they face, then you would weed out these kind of people who will abuse it or going through their own kind of PTSD. But we have to try to make the system better.
One of our lead, Amanda Seifert, got very invested in and close to two women who work as police officers in Philadelphia. She came to Philly to do research before shooting began and went on a ride along with some members of the police and was, I think, very moved by these two police officers she met, both of whom were single mothers. I think she used a lot of the trauma that they had experienced on and off the job to inform her acting in the role as well. As a writer of fiction, I'm never interested in oversimplification. My first job is to portray everybody as a human with flaws. And Mickey in particular is somebody that I think one of the things that may hopefully differentiate her from some other representations of police officers that we've seen in film, TV, and books is that she knows she's not a good police officer. She's not talented at her job. In fact, one of the reasons I chose the passage that I chose is because she's saying, I'm not brave. I'm not physically brave. I'm not good at my job. I'm smart, but I'm not the right type of smart for this work. But because she grew up without resources and without the right kind of mentorship, she's found herself in a job that she's trying to do to the best of her ability, but it's really ultimately probably not the job that she should be doing.
Yeah, and she has those personal reasons. And I do want to go into, you know, you gave her music, which is perhaps a little leaf from your early life coming up through music and poetry. She's classically trained, so that's how she finds those grace notes between the difficult work she does.
Yeah, in the book, her great passion outside of work and her interest was history, and she was very engaged by a high school history teacher she had, and she loved doing research about the neighborhood of Kensington. She was a kind of a nerd in that way, and the city of Philadelphia. Pretty early on, we decided that that was not nearly as dynamic on the screen as something that would have a more visual element to it, a sound element to it as well. And so we gave her music, partly because it was more visually interesting, but did kind of the same task, giving her some interest outside work and maybe something that she should have done instead of police work if she had come from a different family who would have supported those ambitions. She comes from a musical family, just a much different type of musical family. So her grandfather is a mummer in a string band. And so she grew up surrounded by musicians, but a much different kind of musician. So it was interesting to us to play with that kind of like highbrow, lowbrow, or community band versus classically trained orchestra, et cetera.
And so it's interesting because I want to talk about the God of the Woods, which is, again, a very different, you know, you come to a place, you evoke Pennsylvania, Philadelphia very well, and then you evoke the Adirondacks Woods. It's a different, it's a place of privilege. And yet underneath, you know, you're not safe in the city, you're not safe in the woods. So there is a kind of thread, and also the female detective this time, there was a pursuit of missing young people within the same family. So you can set it up now that I've made a mess of it.
I have a long family history in the Adirondacks, and I still go regularly. And the God of the Woods is set there in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York in the 1970s. And it's the story of a wealthy dynastic American family named the Van Lars, who have a sort of summer estate in the woods. And they also found a summer camp down the hill from the estate. In the summer of 1975, they send their own 13-year-old daughter to the camp that they founded. And she very quickly disappears. But the catch is that she is not the first child of theirs to go missing, because 14 years earlier, they also had a son go missing from the same land, although not from the camp per se. So it's a kind of a double mystery. And it too has a lot of, a big theme is class and income equality. Yeah, the sort of how capital is distributed and how that affects our fate as humans.
So you have multiple voices or multiple perspectives in this. And it's set in primarily like in the 70s. I think you have flashbacks also to the 60s sometimes too. I mean, I don't know what that was like recreating it, even though you have this sense of history. I mean, you didn't experience that so much directly. So what was it like? What was your archaeology of research of going into this milieu?
It was really interesting because in some ways I was researching my own family's history to do it. I have ancestors on my mother's side who moved from other parts of the Northeast to the Adirondack Mountains in the early 1800s when there was this big push by the government of the state of New York to populate upstate. And they were farmers. They formed two separate small family farms, and they lived there for about a century until a large government work project displaced them. Just south of the region, which is where my mother and my grandmother were born and raised. In the 1960s, my grandparents built a house in the southern Adirondacks, actually not far from the site of my earlier ancestors. We still have the house in our family, and we still go every summer ever since I was born. And my kids go, and they love it, and it's a very special ancestral home for us. The history that I was researching, I worked with a genealogist to uncover some parts of my family history, but it also is a really direct parallel to American history in that time. My ancestors were not wealthy, nor were my grandparents or my parents. The family, there were these great American families, wealthy American families like the Roosevelts and the Vanderbilts and eventually the Rockefellers, who discovered the Adirondacks as a kind of summer playground and built these palatial estates in the area. And it was only after they began to take an interest in the area that the Adirondack Park was formed, thus preventing lumbering on the land or overbuilding on the land, which tells you a lot about who wields the power in the United States, because for a long time, the Adirondacks were decimated by the lumber industry until the wealthy discovered that this is very beautiful, at which point almost all lumbering ceased within the Adirondack Park. So a lot of my historical research was about that. In terms of the more recent history, because the book is really, you know, in some ways, there aren't many scenes set back then, but the beginning of the story is really with the formation of the Adirondack Park and the first Van Laar who moved there in the summer. In terms of the history in the 60s and 70s, some of that was conversations that I had with my own family, because my parents and my mother's brother and sister were young people. I guess they would have been in their 20s in the 70s or 30s, 20s and 30s. And they have strong memories of the region in that time, including very strong memories of a real serial killer whose name is Robert Garrow, who haunted the Adirondacks in the 70s and who sort of served as the inspiration for a secondary character in the book named Jacob Sluder. That was the kind of horrifying sense of force of evil wandering around in the background that caused me to set the book during that time, although Sluder is not the main character of the novel.
I'm wondering, because it does seem like there are a lot of serial killers in America, and why?
Oh my gosh. I think, so one of the major themes of the book is the perils of libertarianism, the perils of being too siloed, and the perils of a community that's not communal enough or that creates outsiders in both serial killers and perpetrators of gun violence or mass shootings. There's a sense always that those were the people who were kept out of the community, who were outsiders in a lot of ways, and who usually experienced abuse, especially in the case of serial killers. Almost all serial killers were abused as children in one way or another. I think there's a certain thread in American history of like individualism at all costs. The Van Laars named their house Self-Reliance, which is a testament to the idea that they, I think, falsely believe themselves to have created their own power, their own capital, their own wealth, and ignore the fact that it's really the labor of the working class community around them and of the people of Albany who've invested their money in the Van Laars Bank that really contributed to the acquisition of this enormous wealth and power that they now have. So I think they're sort of two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, property is theft. I don't know that's a simplification, but I think it's interesting. And then beyond that, it's not just in America, but we see there's this undercurrent of rage, even with social media, that just seems like, wow, I didn't know that was there.
Yeah, a sense that I think income inequality really greatly contributes to the rage that people might feel, even as some Americans won't. What they see instead is, why don't I have what that person has? Something's getting in my way. And it's not a lack of community. It's somebody else is keeping me down. And that's a theme that emerges in The God of the Woods as well.
there's this huge promise of the American dream. Maybe if there wasn't such a promise that we felt, oh, it's very egalitarian and you won't get very much, then you wouldn't have this rage of what you deserve.
Kind of a pyramid scheme.
I think that's the truest thing you said. Yeah. No, I want to say before Catherine comes in is it was, we kind of hinted at it, but I didn't say it. And of course, it's the subject of your first book, The Words of Every Song, that you are a musician. You came up through that. So I kind of mentioned that, but I wanted just to say for those who don't know, I mean, and just very briefly, you know, how did that inform your appreciation of the rhythm and beauty of language and its musicality?
Yeah, my father is an amateur pianist, but obsessed with classical music and has always played classical music throughout my life. And in his retirement, now spends like 5 hours a day playing his piano and is very, very happy about it. I guess I grew up hearing a lot of classical music. I studied piano, but never showed my dad's gifts or ambition in that regard. But when I got to high school, I taught myself guitar and started figuring out how to play songs, mostly folk songs. By the time I got to college, I was in New York City and I had begun writing songs. I was working in a guitar store on the weekends and met people there who would become members of a short-lived band that I had and started playing small shows in little clubs and venues in New York City mainly. That was a really formative experience for me. I was for a time more drawn to music than writing fiction. It was only because of my experience playing music that I wrote my first novel, which was called The Words of Every Song, and which was largely based on experiences I had playing those small shows, working in the store, doing an internship in a rehearsal studio. You know, like I was just very ensconced in the music scene in New York at the just after the turn of the millennium. And that's how my first book came about. And then from there, I thought, like, am I ever going to do that again? Or was that really just my music that made that book? But I quickly discovered that I really missed the routine of writing. And so I decided I would give it a shot. And I applied for MFA programs after I had published a first novel, which is a little unusual. But in my case, it was just sort of like, I'm going to try it. I'm going to do 2 years where I devote myself to writing fiction and see if it's for me and see if it's something I want to pursue seriously. And now here I am. And I really don't play music anymore. I play for my kids, but I haven't played a show in 15 years.
Some people say it's harder to write novels. Some people say it's harder to write music. I mean, I don't know where you come on that, but they're very different skills, but they flow into each other.
I mean, writing a novel certainly takes a much longer time than writing a song, but there's a technical element. I mean, you have to have a certain amount of skill or knowledge to write a song.
My name is Catherine Bobao, and I'm a student at Fordham University studying film and communications. Before we hear more about Liz Moore's expansive and inspiring career, I wanted to take this time to talk about a moment that really struck me during our conversation. Liz Moore mentioned her desire to come onto the project of developing Long Bright River for the screen in the role of executive producer in an effort to ensure that the community is represented in a respectful manner. She goes on to talk about how her experiences writing creative nonfiction within the Philadelphia community shaped her understanding of the setting for her novel. She spent time teaching the women there and volunteering in an effort to help make a difference. Years later, when she would sit down to write Long Bright River, these moments and conversations worked to create an authentic and realistic world for the reader. It was so fascinating to hear how her earlier life experiences inadvertently helped move the way she would later write this novel and approach its thematic elements. She then later went on to discuss how in her role as a university professor, she has had students approach her with worries that they would only have one or two books in them. I found her words of encouragement particularly inspiring when she said that in those moments, she reminds her students that with each passing year of life comes a swarm of new experiences to draw from. She mentions that no matter what path your life takes, there is always a story to find along the way, if only we dare to look for them. It's not just her knack for the written word that makes her novel so gripping, but her clear understanding of the human experience. She talked about her character Mickey in Long Bright River and Judy in God of the Woods, delving into how both are flawed human beings with their own unique stories to tell. Each of these characters feel real to the reader because there is something so raw and human about them. It is this rare quality to find in a novel that makes Moore's book so compelling. Ultimately, what drew me in most of the conversation was her ability to perfectly describe what it means to write about the truth of the human experience without shying away from the harsh topics like addiction or class restrictions. So with that in mind, let's continue our conversation with Liz and delve deeper into what it means to write honest, relatable stories. Now back to the interview. Yeah, that's really interesting. And kind of going back to Long Bright River and The God of the Woods, both Mickey and Judy are women navigating traditionally male-dominated fields. You know, you have Mickey in policing and Judy in investigative work. So I'm curious, what draws you to these kinds of characters, and how did you approach Judy differently from Mickey?
That's a great question. Judy was sort of an accident. Because I had just written Long Bright River, which was from the point of view of a female police officer, when I started writing The God of the Woods, I thought, I'm not going to have a law enforcement character. I don't want to do the same thing twice. But I very quickly discovered that I needed somebody with access to the files to help solve the mystery, which is why Judy really only enters The God of the Woods about, I don't know, maybe a third of the way in or a quarter of the way in. For a time, I just thought I'd have the counselors and the family and the campers be the ones revealing all the information. When I started writing Judy, I think a big difference between Mickey and Judy is that Judy has a hugely strong family bond, but almost to her detriment. So Mickey comes from a family where the adults were either addiction or traumatized or in mourning, and they were really not around and not supportive at all. Conversely, Judy comes from a family where she's absolutely loved and treasured and overprotected. But in order to do her job well, she actually has to break out of it and find her own version of self-reliance to get what she needs from the case, which also means moving out of her family home. I also think Mickey is somebody who prides herself on her intellect, and she's an autodidact. She reads everything there is to read. Her point of pride is that she's very, very smart, whereas I think Judy is sort of, she describes herself as average in every way, and yet she's got an instinct for investigation. Judy is arguably a better cop than Mickey is, more suited to her job. It's interesting. Anytime I start a new book, one of the first exercises I do is like, am I writing the same book in any way as any book I've ever written before? And the answer is almost always yes, because every author has the same themes that crop up over and over again. But part of the job of being an author is to make sure that you are offering something new to the reader, I think, with every book.
I totally agree. And I think that as a reader of your books, I can say you are definitely offering something new to the reader each time I pick up one of your novels. So kind of moving on, I'm curious, when it comes to blending genres, do you think genre labels help or limit how your books are received by maybe readers and publishers?
I think genre is a really interesting question. I don't feel limited by genre, and I think that my readers don't either. I think there's a lot of mixed genre books out there right now. And what I'm noticing is that readers really like a good story, and they like a good story with deep character development and a pretty specific sense of place. I think with Long Bright River, it was the first book of mine that was marketed specifically as a thriller, and I think even the covers reflect this. The cover of Long Bright River, especially the U.S. cover, looks very procedurally. It's this dark blue color. It has kind of lettering that looks almost like knife slashes. Its cover tells its readers, this is a mystery, this is a thriller. At first, I was a little bit wary of that because I had already published 3 books and none of them looked like that. And to my mind, the only thing that really made it a thriller is the fact that the narrator was a police officer. But other than that, it felt similar to me to my other books. What my publishers believed is that it's easier to get readers of thrillers to cross over into literary fiction or, you know, realistic fiction than it is to get readers of literary fiction to cross over into thrillers than vice versa. And I think they were probably right because the book did pretty well. With The God of the Woods, maybe because my name was kind of more established in that space, I think Riverhead Books, my publisher, felt more free to give it a cover that they felt would reflect the book. And the American cover of The God of the Woods is very beautiful. It's a painting of a forest. And there's this very weird pink drip coming down from the top. I love the cover of The God of the Woods. I think it's really brilliant. But yeah, I'm not bothered. Whatever people want to call my books, they can call my books, as long as they read them.
That's funny, and that's a really good point. So my next question is, you had mentioned earlier that you felt really strongly about being an executive producer because you wanted to make sure that you represented the community properly. So I'm interested in if there were any other moments where you felt you had to really advocate for something in the story that you wanted to see on the screen.
The question of accents came up a lot while working on the Long Bright River series. There's a very specific Philadelphia accent, and there's an even more specific Kensington accent. One thing that I think I did not want, and I think others agreed ultimately, is for our Mickey to learn and put on a Kensington accent, because it felt to me like her character, who strives so hard to differentiate herself from the people she grew up with and who has a sort of like snobbery to her that people call out frequently, would also have worked to have a more neutral accent and to be able to code switch a little. And so Amanda did not put on a Kensington accent, a Philadelphia accent. She spoke with a pretty neutral American accent. And I think that was the right choice for her character. It's certainly how I described her in the book. A lot of people say, like, you don't sound like you're from around here, even though she is and she grew up there. But I wanted her to feel like the outsider she was in all circumstances.
Yeah, and being an outsider and this kind of loner, someone, you know, observing rather than so much in the middle of things, seems to be a streak that runs throughout your novels. But I'm also wondering, through this experience of being an executive producer, which we know your cast and crew can be like over 100. So being more out in the world, does that change the kind of scope of characters or the kinds of characters you are drawn to write about?
Yeah, I think I'd have a hard time writing from the point of view of a character who was like extremely gregarious and social. I certainly write those characters. They exist in my fiction, but they're not usually the focus of the book. They're supporting characters. My husband is extremely gregarious and outgoing and a classic extrovert. Both of my children, I think, are classic extroverts. Even in my own family, sometimes I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm the only one who needs quiet at any moment. On the other hand, they've also conditioned me to really love and appreciate extroverts and to feel pretty at ease around them. And so just as an observation exercise, I know, I can imagine, because they've told me and because I observe, what they derive from group settings, being out, the pleasure they get from company. When you love people who exhibit very different characteristics than you do, then that becomes a tool for writing those characters as well.
And also having two children, being a mother, being a wife, writing these books where the place of childhood, these relationships are so central to it. How do you reflect upon those experiences when you're writing these stories?
Well, it really ups the stakes for me, and it does not take any work to imagine the panic that one would feel in searching for a lost child, for example. I was just having a conversation with a student. I teach at Temple University in Philadelphia in the MFA program. And one of my students was asking, well, at a certain point, don't you just run out of ideas? What if I only have one book in me or two books in me? And I said, might, you know, some people do only have one or two books in them. But remember, every chapter of your life brings with it new experiences and thus new inspiration. So I have no idea if that student will become a parent at some point or will form a lifelong partnership with somebody at some point. But each of those milestones brings a huge number of new stories and new sources of inspiration. And in fact, conversely, being in one's 40s and having chosen not to have children also offers a new wealth of stories, because every decade brings with it a different community and a different place within the community. Life brings stories. Living one's life naturally brings new stories.
So as a teacher, I strongly believe that teachers are so important. We're now seeing a big shakeup within the universities. So much is changing. So who are those teachers that are important for you? What are those things that you tell your students? What were some of those important lessons that you like to pass on?
Yeah, I had wonderful teachers throughout my education, beginning with my public school teachers. I grew up in a town called Framingham, Massachusetts. My public school teachers did a terrific job of educating me and also providing encouragement to me for my writing. And then I got to college and I was able to study with working creative writers like Mary Gordon, who was a college professor of mine, whom I loved, and Roddy Doyle, who was a visiting professor at Barnard, who was a big inspiration for me as well. Also somebody who wrote about music, who played music, and who wrote fiction about it, which was important to me early on. In grad school, I studied with Colm McCann, Peter Carey, and Nathan Englander, who are three writers whose work I really, really admire. Every one of them had a different lesson to teach me. A lot of them just had to do with finding discipline and stamina, because so much of writing is just actually doing the writing. I was always very inspired as a writer. I always felt like I had a lot of things to write about, but it took me a long time to find the motivation and the stamina and the discipline to actually sit down and write. So much of what I talk about with my students is how to develop a routine, how to develop a habit, how not to be discouraged when it's time to edit. It's just as a matter of course, your first draft is not your final draft. And you're going to get big notes and big headlines that are annoying because they mean big work is ahead of you. But that's kind of the way it goes. I've never written a book that hasn't undergone several complete transformations from start to finish.
Yeah, I think it's important, but essential for growth. So now what's changing in the last few years is the advent of AI. It's changing the way we're communicating with ourselves, our imagination. Some people see it as a short track to easy perfection. I mean, what are your views on that and your general reflections on the handmade and the human made?
So I wrote a whole book about this. The Unseen World is the story of a father and a daughter in Boston in the 1980s through the near future. And it's about the dawn of natural language processing in computers and artificial intelligence more generally, and eventually virtual reality. So I did a lot of research on it. I was very interested and read a biography of Alan Turing as a kid, and it's just stuck with me ever since. And I became really interested in the Turing test. And it's interesting, when I wrote The Unseen World, no machine had yet passed what is called the Turing test. And now, of course, machines, I mean, with flying colors, you cannot differentiate between machine and human in writing anymore, or sometimes in speaking. I wrote The Unseen World, and it was not meant to be a pessimistic look at the future of artificial intelligence. It was, I think, quite optimistic, actually. What I am more afraid of are the humans behind the artificial intelligence, because what I think we're finding is that nefarious motives on their part influences the AI to do nefarious things. And so that's what scares me much more than artificial intelligence per se. I think it could be used as a great force of good in the world, but I'm not sure that it will be because of who's behind it.
Yeah, the bad actors. Yeah, that was prescient, and we see it as more and more now. On the note of the Turing test, they're saying the way people can tell is they say, oh, an AI doctor, a real doctor, they say, oh, he's too excellent, or she's too excellent, this is too good, too complete.
Yes.
So, yeah, just in closing, as someone who's written so much about place, and particularly in your last novel, you do, I imagine, get a lot of inspiration from the natural world. So perhaps you could share some memories of the beauty and wonder of the natural world.
Yeah, if the Adirondacks are a favorite place for me, it's a stunningly well-preserved part of the United States. You can go there and feel like you're really stepping back in time. And I'm lucky I get to do some writing up there every year as well. The internet does not reach it. There is no cell phone service, which I love. We do have a landline, but we have no TV. We don't have Wi-Fi because it would require a very expensive cable to be placed underground. And so it is the most peaceful place I can imagine. We're surrounded by trees. We can look at a lake. All the sounds of nature are very much a part of the house. And it's the most calm and beautiful place I know. And I can't wait to get back there this summer. We usually start going back there in about May. So it's a very special place for me.
Well, thank you, Liz Moore, for creating stories that inspire us to care, and by shining a light on those single lives, we can see beyond the statistics and regain a sense of community and understand that a better world is possible. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you so much, Mia. Really great conversation. Thank you.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This episode was conducted by Mia Funk and Catherine Bulbao with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer on this episode were Katie Foster and Catherine Bulbao. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Associate text editor was Ash Fisher. Additional production support was by Sophia Garnia. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anandolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.